First Nations, and waves of immigrants. But when it comes to equality, there seems to be a huge difference between white Canadians and non-whites. One of the major differences is the income gap. At the moment, Canada's income gap is at a record high. Experts say that there are two factors contributing to this growing gap: a widening disparity in labor earnings between high and low-paid workers, and less redistribution. Taxes and benefits also reduce inequality, less in Canada than in most countries.
When it comes to native people, well, like the Palestinians in Western Asia, you know, native people are indigenous to this territory, and this territory has been taken, in some cases, you know, violently and ruthlessly from the indigenous peoples, and they were pushed out of even citizenship. So there's been a great theft of resources and wealth from the indigenous peoples, and it's been devastating in its effect on people's psychology, their ability to adapt to the current economy.
How bad is Canada's economy doing anyways? Maybe the question should be, prior to the COVID-19, was it underperforming? Well, don't take our word for it. Let's look at the Bank of Canada and what it has done. First, it has said that Canada's financial system is resilient. Yet a closer look reveals that there are high levels of household debt. And you guessed it, money that the bank has lent to households. Now, the central bank has also said that the longer the pandemic affects jobs and incomes, the greater the risk of financial trouble for households and businesses. Basically, that's another way of saying that risks to households, businesses, and markets actually remain. When it comes to businesses, the usual ones are the victims, like businesses in other countries across the world, including transportation, arts and entertainment, for example, accommodation, and food services. Now it's time to look at what has affected Canada's neighbor, the U.S., severely. Food insecurity.
Food insecurity is yet another challenge people in less privileged communities face in Canada. As some food banks are forced to close, daycares and schools close also, and paychecks stop. And people of all ages and backgrounds may face food insecurities. For those who were already food insecure, the situation is worse. A meal, let alone a nutritious meal, may not be accessible.
Disparities in the cost of living in different areas. It's very expensive to live in the Toronto area. It would be less expensive to live in, say, Regina. So the issue of minimal wage, this is important. We see a growing poverty. We see poverty in Canada. Largely along the lines of, you know, native people are at an extreme disadvantage in the economy.
Canada's minority groups, including the indigenous populations, are now facing greater challenges. For example, overcrowding in housing makes social distancing, self-isolation, or quarantining an issue.
Far more heavily incarcerated. They go to jail at a much higher rate than blacks in the United States.
In northern remote isolated and urban indigenous communities, there may be 10 people living in a space designed for two or three. Housing in disrepair also serves to support transmission of respiratory illnesses.
The resource-based economy, especially oil and gas. Oil and gas is very difficult. The price of oil and gas is very low. And there's been a great emphasis on building pipelines from the Alberta tar sands across the mountains so that the bitumen can be shipped to China.
Okay, today we have a special guest joining us for this edition of the program. His name, Robert Hux. He's a spokesman for the Committee for the Republic of Canada, Canada Liaison for Schiller Institute. He was also contributor to the Canadian Patriot, News from the Northern Front, the edition which focused on Canada's struggle for nationhood and the Round Table movement. Robert Hux, welcome to Economic Divide. First question, before the pandemic, Canada's economic indicators, they weren't that great, and now the pandemic has obviously affected the economy severely. The real GDP, according to one report, has fallen 18% in the 2 months, which none of the other four recessions actually even came close. Is that how bad Canada's economy is doing at this point?
Yes, well, what you're describing is this is not particular to Canada. All of the G7 countries were hit quite hard by the pandemic. Now, I think the question that should be asked is why were certain Asian countries, and particularly why was China able to deal with this pandemic so much better than the G7 nations, for example? Because this, you know, in late December of 2019, was a disease that was not clearly defined what it was. Very rapidly, China took the emergency measures so that that by the end of February, they had using public health measures and a huge mobilization, they had gotten the pandemic under control.
In terms of Canada's wages, there have been doubts that it has actually led to income inequality. Are Canadians not earning enough to actually cover their expenses? For example, Canada's rate per hour wage is $13.01, yet in Ontario, the rate is calculated to be at least $15.40 per hour.
Well, first off, the late economist Lyndon LaRouche emphasized that the only competent approach to economics is from the standpoint of what he calls physical economics. And in physical economics, you do not take as primary money. You do not take as primary even, for example, a factory producing X number of million tons of widgets per year. What you take as primary is the entire national economy, and on the larger scale, the entire world. And the question that that a physical economist has to answer is what are the measures that have to be taken by, for example, the government of my country in collaboration with the government of other countries around the world to ensure that 50 years from now, mankind is positioned to be able to meet the challenges that we will surely meet. Publication put out by Lyndon LaRouche's associates called the Executive Intelligence Review produced a special report in at the end of May of this year entitled The LaRouche Program to Reopen the Economy. The world needs 1.5 billion productive jobs. And it said if you take the figures that was that have been provided by the International Labor Organization, using figures from 2019, the world population is about 7.7 billion people. The labor force of the world is roughly 3.5 billion people. Now, if you look at the number of those 3.5 billion people who are employed in what's called formal jobs, formal employment, and you add to that the number of people that are employed in the informal economy, you're looking at beyond that the number of people that are unemployed, and a fourth category, the number of people who might get a paycheck or might be collecting money, but are not doing anything of productive value for their nation or the world. For example, people selling cigarettes on a street corner. Or what they call, in the United States or Canada, the gig economy. This could even include things such as, hotels, restaurants, things that are not physically productive. And by productive, Mr. LaRouche means the production of the food, the raw materials, the intermediate goods required to physically reproduce the ability to maintain the existing human population and allow for growth.
Final question, poverty, another economic indicator that's not going the right direction for Canada. February 2020, a report has said that the 2018 income tax return saying that 3.2 million Canadians were living below the poverty line. Discrimination and systemic inequality rather than the lack of or poor individual choice to be the main reasons. Why is this the case, especially among the indigenous, the visible minority, immigrants and single-parent families?
Well, first off, as I said, you have to sort of look at this from a higher standpoint. One of the things that began occurring from the 1971 takedown of the Bretton Woods system on was the development, you know, at a later point, of these free trade agreements, such as the North American Free Trade Act. Our organization put out a special report at that time entitled Auschwitz Below the Border, referring to the U.S.-Mexican border, because you were essentially, you know, creating conditions where people who were working in the United States at a certain higher wage associated with a skilled trade, these jobs, you know, fled to Mexico or eventually other places, including China at one point. Based on this idea, which is a British outlook of economics, the way to get wealthy according to the British imperial outlook is to buy something cheap and sell it very expensively. And if you control finance, if you can control, you know, transportation networks and so forth, that's the way that you supposedly get wealthy. But that precisely is the model that is now broken down. The coronavirus pandemic just exposed the underlying dysfunction of the entire world economy because of that. And so I think that we should be, if we were prepared to work with China and look at what they have actually done, just recently, China has announced that the last remains of extreme poverty in China have now been eliminated. It's not that people are not poor in China, you know, because they're talking about, you know, absolute poverty. But how did they do this? They did this through, in some cases, if people are living in mountainous, remote regions, it's very difficult to deal with the situation. They would move them to an area where they could get a productive employment. And Canada, as well as the United States, could learn some lessons from that kind of approach.
Okay, very well. Thank you very much for that. Robert Hux, the spokesman for the Committee for the Republic of Canada. All right, it's time for a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere. We have plenty more coming up in the next half of the program. Current Affairs and Impact Analyst Mon Abedin will be joining us. He will share with us some posts, such as wealth tax. Could that be the answer to Canada's economic woes? Also look at how employment losses were greater for younger, low-wage, and non-unionized workers in Canada. And finally, a look at gender gap in the next half, and surprisingly how race plays an important role in income inequality. Hello, welcome back to Economic Divide. This is our in-depth section. When it comes to income inequality, the basic question we are asking is Canada becoming more unequal? We're going to set out the three findings that we came up with. First is income inequality to have increased over the past 20 years. Second, richest group increased its share of total national income, while the poorest group lost its share. And finally, we're going to take a look at how Canadians in the poorest income group still saw their income levels rise, albeit minimally. Okay. Now, the report titled The Affordability Education, written in 2019, discusses the rising concern about how the cost of living in Canada and how it presents a threat and opportunity to progressives, a report commissioned by the Broadbent Institute. Going on to what we thought was important, here you can see one in four Canadians cite financial issues, taxes, or housing as the thing keeping them up at night. Moving on to the next, cost of living, housing affordability, wages, inequality, and taxes. Well, these are things that are actually vote drivers. 57% rank an issue tied to the cost of living, wages, or taxes as their top issues. Moving on to the next finding that we have here, almost half of Canadians are worried about their cost of living. It's broken it down, asking a question how worried Canadians are, and it says women are more worried than men. Concern crosses all age groups, however, and that worry is directly related to household income. So we can see how household income obviously has an effect when it comes to the economy. And here, again, cost of living, in terms of how worried Canadians are about it, it's broken it down to the level of income from 35,000, moving upwards, 35 to 50, 50 to 75, all the way up to 150,000 K. And of course, you can see the trend that exists here. And what this means is that, well, Canadians are worried about their cost of living. They want to have enough income to pay for things that they want in life, things such as rent, such as everyday costs. While most Canadians feel that the cost of living and income inequality has gotten worse over the past few years, they don't think that corporate profits have been hurt. In fact, 73% believe that corporate profits have actually improved or stayed about the same over the past few years.
The economic pain in Canada has not been evenly distributed. In a report published by four Canadian economists, it was revealed that employment losses were greater for younger, low-wage, and non-unionized workers, with public-facing sectors like retail and restaurants to have been hit the hardest. Previous analyses have shown that women are being disproportionately affected. The report showed that the labor market impact of the COVID-19 pandemic has been harsher on those workers who hold the least bargaining power.
Freefall, and it's largely created by government forcing on the public lockdowns, locking down our societies, our businesses. People can't go out to eat, can't do the usual things. It seems it's being purposely done according to some agenda that seeks to destroy the economy.
Time now to bring in Mahan Abedin. He is our current affairs and impact analyst who joins us in the studio. Mahan, welcome.
Thank you.
So you have some posts that you want to share with us?
Absolutely, and they are focused on Canada. Of course, Canada is struggling with pretty much the same financial woes that much of the Western world is grappling with, including the U.S. So here, focus on progressive wealth tax would provide that amount of funds to fight wealth inequality. Again, sounds very good in theory, but how practical are these plans? We all know that tax regimes are very hard to design and even harder to implement. So yeah, this tweet strikes me with being made with very good intentions. I'm just not sure how practical it is.
Well, it shows how important inequality overall and wealth inequality in particular is.
Sure.
When they have to, or when they're thinking about a wealth tax.
Well, you know, with Canada, it's always framed as this progressive country in North America, especially in relation to the U.S. But in reality, it's suffering from, broadly speaking, the same structural, financial, fiscal issues as the U.S. is, but on a much smaller scale, obviously,
sure,
given its size. So there's hardly anything progressive about Canada from a financial point of view.
Okay, let's move on to the next screen here.
Sure. So, impact of the pandemic, again, similar issues we see in America, foreign workers, immigrants, refugees, international students. This shows you the problems Canada is grappling with, but it doesn't really give you any solutions.
It's hard to look at this and not think about whether this might be also pointing towards the fact that perhaps there's discrimination when it comes to foreign workers, immigrants,
yes,
refugees, and international.
Again, that goes back to the heart of what I said earlier. Canada is often projected as this progressive place, but in reality, it's replete with racism, discrimination, as the U.S. is, right? So,
Okay, the last tweet that you have for us?
Sure. So this is coming from Maxime Bernier. This is coming from a different angle now, basically a right-wing angle, accusing others of being, left-wing politicos, that, their job is not to fight inequalities, to save the Canadian dollar. To me, this speaks of the very hard battles so-called Canadian progressive halves in terms of reforming their country's financial fiscal system. They're grappling with that kind of mentality, which is a very American one. It's kind of right-wing in fiscal terms, super capitalism, free market, and most important of all, low taxation.
That's right. Thank you so much for that.
You're
we
welcome.
Always appreciate your
Thank
input.
You.
Mahan Abedin, a current affairs and impact analyst. Okay, our next focus is the gender gap and how race plays a factor in income inequality in Canada. Do stay with us.
The culture of inequality continues to persist in Canada's capital market sector, and the brunt of it is felt by women and people who are racialized, Indigenous, or other minority groups. According to a study of 600 Canadian finance workers conducted by Women in Capital Markets in 2019, only half of women believed that they were treated equally, and to have the same access to opportunities as other genders at their firm, and just a third thought their company is free from gender bias, that the promotion process was fair and objective. The study revealed that black women were the least likely to say that they were treated equally by their firm and manager, and the least likely to perceive that they have equal career opportunities.
Canada's economy has been battered by the COVID-19 pandemic. That much is definitely known. But the current problems are also an outcome of poor economic policies from the past. We need to mention the First Nation people and how their rights have been violated, along with how they have been deprived of reaping the benefits of what the Canadian economy has to offer. What has Canada done for them recently? And finally, Canada needs to address its inequality issues soon in order to not have this be another virus on top of the coronavirus that has plagued its people and society. That's all the time we have for this week's episode. We hope you've enjoyed the show. On behalf of myself, Trevor Tapley, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We are discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on sermon number 184 in Nahjul Balagha. Piety is one of the most important pillars of any religion, and the religion of Islam has given special emphasis on this virtue, and has there are various texts of various kinds from our leaders, from our scholars, from the prophets of Islam, from the prophets from the beginning of time till now, from the very time immemorial. You can start from Prophet Adam onwards. All of them had teachings regarding the importance of piety and the qualities of those who are pious. We are discussing the sermon number 184. We reach this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam says that tarahu qariban amaluhu kalilan zalaluhu khashi'an qalbuh, that you will see that a pious person is one whose hopes are, whose goals, whose hopes are near, they are not far-fetched. Qalilan zalaluhu, his mistakes are very few. And the final one is khashi'an qalbuh, you'll see that his heart is humble. And we started this topic of the humility of the heart in the previous session. We shall inshallah continue with it in this session.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence, from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, we say that khushu is a state of inherent humility, which is expressed by the heart, which is felt in the heart. And this is the result of witnessing the greatness and the majesty of God. When a person contemplates on how great God is, Him being the source of all existence as it is, as we know it and as we do not know it, for those things that we are unaware of also, the greatness of all of these entities, if a person just imagines how great and how humongous the universe is, he cannot maybe believe, or his mind will not be able to calculate. Just imagine. Some of the scientists say that the amount of stars that a person can see in the night, or for example, are viewable when a person looks towards the sky at any point in time, are more than even the amount of grain that is there, the grains of sand that are there in, for example, Sahara Desert. So if these are the amount of stars that exist in just the sky that can be seen, let alone the further galaxies and all those other heavenly bodies that exist further away, if a person would just imagine therefore how great this universe is. And then if you look at the riwayat and the narrations that tell us that this particular universe is the weakest and the lowest universe. Rather, there are higher realms beyond this material universe. Then a person would understand how great, or have a very vague understanding of how great God is, and how weak and how minuscule He is with regards to His Lord. This brings a state of humility in the heart.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So, when we look at the verses of the Quran, there is one verse that talks about this humility that I will build upon a little bit in this lecture and in the future sessions. He says that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Holy Quran, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم ألم يأني للذين آمنوا أن تخشع قلوبهم لذكر الله وما نزل من الحق. Allah says in the Holy Quran, isn't it time that the believers, the hearts of the believers, became humble towards the remembrance of God and towards what has been revealed from the truth? This is a question that God has asked. Inshallah, we will work on this in the coming segment. Now, the verse that of the Quran that we mentioned here is that Allah is expecting our hearts to become humble. But one of the ways, or one of the signs of the humility of the heart, to bring the heart to a state of humility, is to be in remembrance of God and in remembrance of that which God has revealed. If a person always is in the state of dhikr, that means that state of remembrance of his relationship with God, about the greatness of God, and also about the duties that he has, about the truth that exists in the universe, then slowly the heart will become humble. And in this particular verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَلَا يَكُونُوا كَالَّذِينَ أُوتُوا الْكِتَابَ مِنْ قَبْلِ فطال عليهم الأمد فقست قلوبهم. And don't be like those who are before you, who are given the book, who left the book, who didn't contemplate, who didn't take the book as a remembrance, as a reminder. So their hearts became hard. So on one part we have a heart that is humble, and in the other side we have got a heart that is hard. And both of the hardness and the softness and the humility of the heart is dependent on the way a person receives reminder from contemplating on the book of God and on the realities and the reality of God's existence and His power. وَكَثِيرٌ مِّنْهُمْ فَاسِقُونَ. And Allah says in the end that many of them are people who are transgressors. وَكَثِيرٌ مِّنْهُمْ فَاسِقُونَ. It shows that this attitude of not being in the state of remembrance leads a person finally to achieve or be in the state of being transgressing. Let us pray to Allah to help us avoid this state. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان العين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Salaamun alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. And welcome to the program of Islamic Upbringing, here on IRIB English Radio. In this program, we discuss the problems and questions that parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children.
And the answers are mostly based upon the book, Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmi Aqum. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Brother Miqdad.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah to you and to all the listeners out there.
So, Brother Miqdad, the first question is, my child is 6 years old, and due to the current situation of COVID, we have to stay indoors. And I'm struggling with her feeling really bored at home, and she seems lethargic all day, constantly asking for snacks. Do you have any suggestions? So, Brother Miqdad, it's actually a common question that many parents are having these days. What do you have to say about it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, indeed, we're facing some difficult times, especially with parents. I mean, many parents naturally are struggling with this difficult time where we have to stay indoors. Parks are closed, public places are closed, and naturally, it's a struggle for all parents and completely understandable. Regarding this particular question, I'd like to suggest highlight the importance of exercise and the importance of letting out what child's energy. I think we've mentioned many times previously that children have a lot of energy in them, right? And it's important that they have the opportunity to let out that energy, basically. And we've talked about exercise as a very important physical need that children have, and that they have to be going outdoor, running, jumping, climbing trees, doing all sorts of different sports and exercise. This makes their body strong, it brings balance, and we talked about how this physical need has a very strong impact on their emotional aspect, on the emotional growth that they have. They're feeling happy, they're feeling much more enthusiastic, much more cooperative at home. Their behavior is very much impacted by the level of exercise that they do. And ultimately, we also realize that exercise has a very strong impact on the intellectual and spiritual growth of a child, that research has suggested. I think we've mentioned previously as well, how exercise plays a role in one's academic performance, one's understanding, and on the other side, how sedentary behavior and lack of movement, basically, which is in today's world is quite common, not just because of TV and computer games and everything, but now with COVID on top of that, we have to stay at home and you don't have really space to move around or to jump around, etc. This can have a lot of negative social, mental, physical and behavioral issues, basically. So definitely a struggle that we have to overcome, and one of the ways to overcome is through exercise, and a lot of exercise.
So what about in the situation of lockdown?
So exercise can be in different ways, right? I mean, the ideal situation, the ideal scenario will be to have exercise outside, outdoor, on a social level, basically. So different kinds of sports, whether it's football, basketball, swimming, talking about going to the park to run around with the ball, depending on the child's age and abilities, obviously, and likes in terms of sports. But now with lockdown and the different restrictions that we have, it's up to parents to be very creative and come up with brand new ideas on how to tackle this issue.
Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad. And dear listeners, stay with us and we'll be right back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and
fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So welcome back, dear listeners, to the program of Islamic upbringing. So we're talking to Brother Meghdad about what children can do in the situation of lockdown. So Brother Meghdad, you can continue.
So in terms of being creative, I mean, you can go online and inshallah find a lot of different activities that you can do with your child. Pick out those activities that doesn't require too much preparation, but involves a lot of activity, a lot of sweating and jumping. And sometimes it doesn't take too much if the parents get involved as well. As a mom, for example, dad gets involved, and if you have siblings, and or if you get involved and play a game together, doing this throughout the day would really help to get the child to freshen up, basically, and feel more happy. Sometimes, for example, I don't know, take a balloon, for example, and play a game of trying to keep the balloon up in the air, right? And you have different obstacles to try and make it more challenging for the child. And you realize that mom gets involved, siblings get involved. It becomes a very nice atmosphere. And at the same time, becomes very, very active. And this activity is very, very precious, because it will lead to the child not feeling lethargic anymore, not wanting to snack. The behavior will change, basically, slowly, slowly.
So they need to stay active, don't need to sit idle.
Exactly, yes. I know it's in today's world, it's very easy to switch on the TV and let the child watch TV throughout the day, but that's very, very dangerous. Not just about the content that they're going to learn, but also at a physical level as well. It's not going to help them in any way to feel better about themselves or to be able to grow intellectually and spiritually. So, yes, as much as you can. If you have to stay indoors, then try and plan different activities throughout the day. I know sometimes it's an effort, but those kind of challenges that we have to go through. Use the internet, you'll find different activities online to be able to keep the child as much active as possible. So if you have access to a garden, that's ideal as well. And then from time to time, there's other things that you can do outside. So I know the conditions might not allow this all the time, but if there is, I don't know, if you can go outside the city for a ride, for those cities don't have a lockdown. For instance, climbing a small hill or a mountain, that's probably one of the best exercises out there, is to climb a mountain. Because
so you're basically talking about physical activities.
Physical activity, basically. Physical activities with the family, ideally, to get the child to be on their toes, on their feet, basically, the whole day. And things like mountain climbing is very, very useful, because mountain climbing is not just a physical sport, but it has a lot of impact on different aspects of one personality, because it's a challenge. When you reach the top, you're really tired, you now have to go back down.
True.
It sometimes involves a lot of teamwork, because you have to help one another. If you have siblings, you have to stay on the same pace and make sure you don't go too fast or too slow. You have to plan together.
Yeah, that's actually cool.
Exactly, yeah. So it involves a lot of things together, which is quite it's quite refreshing, basically, for children. And they're
also adventurous.
It's adventurous as well, yes. So if you have those kind of rural places that you can go outside of the city, then that's definitely worth it, and I would recommend that. Another thing I'd like to mention over here, since we're talking about this, is the fact that it's important to make sure that, and I know this is difficult in this COVID period, but it's to make a child feel challenged, basically. Sometimes we try and make the grounds for the child in such a way that everything's very smooth and running, and there's no issues or difficulties in a child's life. I don't mean to say that you have to purposely create a difficult situation or purposely annoy the child to make him feel kind of pain. No, that's not what I mean. I mean that part of life should be that children should face challenges, should face difficulties of life.
Like what?
So when we talk about mountain climbing, for example, it's a difficult challenge, right, at times. And this is a good thing. Or for example, when you're out in the garden and you want to build something, carrying a heavy stone, let the child carry the heavy piece of wood, for example, that you want to build, let's say, a wood house. Or allow the child to do certain things that might perhaps be slightly, not dangerous, but might slightly make them feel a bit of pain, for example. Uh-huh. That's perfectly fine. For example, using a couple of tools, using a hammer, for example, right? A 6-year-old, 7-year-old should be able to use a hammer. I know at times it's possible that they might hurt themselves, but it's part of life for children to learn the difficulties of life, basically. Yeah. As parents, we need to not cover them in a bubble, overprotect them so much that they don't feel difficulties of life.
Dear listeners, thank you so much for joining with us, and we'll be right back after a short break.
Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said, "It is a recommended practice for a child to play in his childhood so that he becomes patient in his adulthood."
Welcome back, the audience of IRIB English Radio. And we're talking what kids can do in the situation of lockdown. How can they keep themselves busy? So we're talking to Brother Mehrdad, and I would like him to continue.
So we were talking about the importance of making children feel challenged, children feeling the difficulties of doing things. One of the things that they have over here locally is these trips that they go on. I think we have them in different countries, all scouts, basically.
Yeah.
When you go out in camping, for instance, or in the forest, for instance, and you're in charge of different difficult tasks, which are part of the journey, basically.
Yeah.
So whether it's, I don't know, putting up a tent or digging up a place for the toilet or making a fire to cook food. One of the results of these trips is that children come out much stronger.
Yeah.
Children come out much more able and skilled to do things. As opposed to when we try and overprotect the child so much that they become kind of spoiled and lazy or unable to, don't have the skills basically to face the challenges of the world.
So parents should let their children learn new stuff.
Exactly. They should allow the child to learn new stuff, learn new skills, even though if that means that they might feel pain, they might get tired.
They build themselves up.
Exactly. They need to be built themselves up, basically. So that's very important. And especially in these lockdown periods where we're at home, and when you're at home, you're not challenged, you're not facing any sort of difficulty, you're lazing about, basically, all day. And as parents, we should try as much as we can to not allow that to happen, because on a long term, this will have negative consequences. So it requires us parents to really be creative, really put some effort towards this, to try and get children to not just to exercise, not just to be active, not just to be on their feet and sweating and jumping and running and having their heartbeats go really, really fast,
okay,
with a lot of fun, with a lot of joy. But at the same time, we need to make sure that these children are challenged, they're facing the difficult tasks that are important tasks to take, they feel important about themselves, that they're being able to achieve things, and they learn skills that are life skills, basically.
Yeah.
This is something really quite important.
So that was actually a really good explanation. So parents should not just let their children, sit idle at home. They should allow them to learn new stuff. So parents, so just let your children go out and learn new things. So you can take them to a park. You can take them, for mountain climbing, rappelling, grappling, and all. So dear listeners, this was your host, Hassanain, and I'm really thankful to Brother Mehrdad for being with us. And dear listeners, thank you for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir, and visit us at our website, parstoday.com. And until another program, God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Everyone, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent.
Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversy surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of the subcontinent, we look into India's military presence in the Maldives. And we will explore the future of India's automobile industry.
With its thousands of islands stretching hundreds of kilometers into the Indian Ocean and straddling crucial sea lanes through which 40% of the world's fuel shipments flow, Maldives has always been a stage for strategic wrestling between both New Delhi and Beijing. For most of its independent history, since 1965, the South Asian archipelagic country has generally enjoyed excellent relations with India, while keeping communication channels open with China as both try to turn their tide in their direction in the Indian Ocean region.
The rapidly shifting geopolitical climate of the Indian Ocean is aggravated by Sino-Indian competition for influence in the Maldives. The island nation needs to upgrade its military capabilities through the acquisition of modern armaments, but apparently lack resources. Situated at the epicenter of a game between China and India for dominance of the Indian Ocean, it has to make the best use of its strategic geopolitical leverage. India has a long-standing relationship with neighboring the Maldives, but recently it is under threat amid a surge in anti-Indian sentiment. Maldivians have taken to social media and hit the streets to protest against India's military presence in their island nation, calling for Indian troops' unconditional and immediate departure. They describe it as a possible threat to their national sovereignty, with conspiracy theories circulating that the presence is a prelude to Indian annexation of Maldivian territory. Further narrowing India's earlier edge, China has made new inroads into the country via funding big infrastructure projects, including major island connecting bridges. Massive constructions in the island of Feidu Finolu, leased until 2016 by Beijing from the Maldivian government for $4 million, have also created rumors that China is establishing a military base there.
Widely perceived as pro-Indian, President Ibrahim Mohamed Soleh was elected with nearly 60% of the votes in 2018. Soleh beat out Abdullah Yameen Abdul Gayoom, who had prioritized closer ties with China. However, there is still speculation that Soleh's government is quietly trying to rebuild ties to China to financially assist its COVID-devastated economy.
India considers the countries in the Indian Ocean, including the Maldives, as part of its sphere of influence. To maintain a geopolitical balance, India has permanently stationed two helicopters and a Dornier surveillance aircraft in the Maldives under a long-standing bilateral defense pact. India has also helped establish a constellation of coastal radars aligned with its own grid on all 26 Maldivian atolls to monitor approaching sea vessels and aircraft. Both the Indian reconnaissance aircraft and choppers deployed, along with the military personnel who operate them, is increasingly viewed with suspicion in the Maldives. Maldivians say no external power is allowed to have forces or facilities at any military base across the country's strategically located atolls following the withdrawal of British troops in 1976, nothing that only India continues to have a boots-on-the-ground presence. As a goodwill gesture to ease tensions, the Indian Navy has recently said that it had provided the Maldives National Defense Force with a Dornier aircraft as per an intergovernmental agreement. The aircraft will reportedly be based in the northern Maldivian base of Hani Madu and nominally be operated, commanded and controlled by the Maldivian military, with the Indian government bearing the aircraft's operating costs.
Now, for some insight, we are joined by Mr. Muad Mohamed Zaki, who is a senior member of Maldivian Democratic Party while in exile. He's a former political prisoner and currently a political activist and not part of any political party. Mr. Zaki, welcome to the subcontinent. So, what is India's strategy to counter China's influence in Maldives?
Well,
Well, before the 2018 presidential elections, some of the leaders of the Maldivian Democratic Party, who are very close with President Modi, had actually already started various online campaigns, basically targeting Chinese investments negatively. This has actually created fear and suspicion in Chinese investments in the country. That was followed by the Indian government's full backing of the Maldivian Democratic Party, is led coalition in the Maldives to run against the pro-China President Yameen, Yameen's government. And after that, India has seen, and India is seen also to be received the backing of Saudi Arabia and the United States in plans for the Maldives. From the time the opposition won the elections, the Indian military has actually increased its presence in the country from north to south drastically. So this is a concern for a country like Maldives, because we are a 100% Muslim country. And we also know the ongoing Kashmiri occupation by India. So this has caused a lot of fear in the country on India's ambitions in the country.
Okay, and what is China's approach to increase its influence in Maldives?
I do not think that China needs to do much other than to sit and watch. All they need to do is to wait and see, because no matter how much loans that India gives the government, the reality of the situation is that in times like COVID-19, no matter how much foreign loans are injected into the economy at the moment to keep it afloat, it's just a short-term solution. At the moment, the government does not seem to have any long-term solutions. The Indian government has taken full control of full advantage of our country's politicians' lack of understanding on international politics and military strategy. We must remind ourselves that the Maldives had only become a multi-party system in 2008, which is not long ago. Therefore, our politicians have not had the time to understand the big political backdoor games that international politics has in play. Nevertheless, China knows very well that if everything else fails, be it this government or the next government, the Maldives will go back to China for help, because China has proven that when it comes to development, it does carry through, even if there are questions to be asked on specific investments.
All right, Mr. Zaki, what is the result of this rivalry for people of the Maldives?
The supporters from both sides of politics has seen that this foreign interference in our country's domestic affairs has wasted a lot of our government's time that could have been actually spent better in planning for the COVID-19 impact on our economy. Supporters of the ruling coalition parties has also been voicing their concern over India's growing military activities in the country and the worsening economic situation. However, their leaders have not given actually much satisfactory answers to the party members. I think this is one of the reasons why the Election Commission had recently announced that the party membership of the ruling coalition party, Maldivian Democratic Party, has been decreasing, while the opposition party's party membership has actually been increasing. I think the Indian government seems to be the only one benefiting from this. They are effectively now controlling our foreign policy as well. At the OIC or any other international platforms, the Maldives seem to be busy defending India instead of finding much-needed assistance for Maldivian families, small businesses, homeowners and renters. Everyone is suffering in the Maldives.
Mr. Zaki, please, let's just take a look at how the global media has covered this situation, and then we can continue.
India has taken a lead over China in their contest for influence in the Maldives. New Delhi would fund the implementation of the Greater Malé Connectivity Project through a $100 million grant and a $400 million line of credit. The project is a 6.7-kilometer long bridge and causeway link that will connect the Maldivian capital Malé with the neighboring islands of Vilengili, Gulifao, and Thilafushi. It also includes the building of a port at Gulifahu and an industrial zone in Thilafushi. Unlike a similar initiative 7 years ago, the new framework for cooperation between the US and Maldivian Departments of Defense went through without objection from India. a leading player in the latest version of the South Asian Great Game, in which China, Japan and the US are contesting for influence. India is also part of Quad, an alliance that includes Australia, Japan and the US. They have held security dialogues and military exercises spanning the Pacific and Indian Ocean.